From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The water is receding in parts of Baton Rouge today, but things are far from normal. About 4,000 people in Louisiana are still in emergency shelters. More than 40,000 homes are destroyed. 13 people so far have died in this week's flooding. President Obama had a briefing last night from FEMA, but the Baton Rouge newspaper The Advocate is calling on him to cut short his vacation and pay a visit. 20 Louisiana parishes have been declared federal disaster areas after what's being called some of the worst flooding ever to hit parts of the state. Tangipahoa Parish is one of them, and Parish President Robbie Miller is on the line. Sir, we are thinking about you in this time.
Well, we really appreciate that, Robin. I'd like to thank NPR for giving us an avenue to get some information out and let the world know what's going on here.
Well, and what are your biggest problems and your biggest needs right now?
Right now, we're in the recovery stage, The biggest thing that in Tangipahoa Parish that's hindering us is the ability for people to gut their homes, I guess you'd say, to start getting all that damaged furniture, walls, just things. You don't realize how much stuff is close to the floor till you get 2, 3, or 4 feet of water in your home.
Right, and it all becomes toxic with mold and.
If you don't get it out, the quicker we can get it out, the less damage there is to the home. The teams, we have a ton of volunteer organizations. We have neighbors helping neighbors. You might have a neighborhood with the whole neighborhood out, and 4 or 5 homeowners will get together and start in one and just move down the street to each other's homes and just getting it done as quickly as they can everywhere. Which one was damaged the most, and the neighborhood attacks it and gets it done. We have some faith-based and some just community-based volunteer organizations that are here volunteering their time, doing it for free just to be, good servants to their neighbor.
Well, we forget as well as, floods don't discriminate. They hit everybody.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we said that. Socioeconomic demographics, none of that matters. And let me tell you, whenever your house is flooded, it doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah. And your police and your first responders, they also have homes that are destroyed, so they're going out to help others while their families are struggling.
During the rescue effort, it was incredible. You have a guy, you talk to him, how are you doing? How are you holding up? Well, I'm good. Somebody across town or across the parish, there's another crew like this getting my family out right now.
Right. Well, and we're hearing terrible stories about people realizing they don't have flood insurance. One man who's profiled on Morning Edition, his mortgage had been sold. He didn't realize it, and they hadn't notified him that his flood insurance had been dropped. Well, is that a problem that people aren't covered?
I haven't specifically heard about that yet, but I'm sure that's an example. There's an example of that somewhere in our parish, and we know that there's a limit on the FEMA assistance of $33,000, what we've heard so far, and I don't know if that's going to be raised. And many of these people, at least 5,200 homes in March flooded, in the March floods that we had, just 5 months, literally 5 months and one day apart did the flood begin. And those people, they're in the same boat repairing their homes. Some of them were not even finished, and they turn around and get flooded again. A lot of questions about how it's going to be handled. I can tell you, though, that our experience with FEMA is that they're professional, they're very fast. In general, and when we talk about the whole bunch, I'm sure there's a specific incident here or there that didn't go as well as it should, but they're very compassionate people. They're working very hard. I know that we have approximately more than 70 FEMA members on the ground in Tangipahoa Parish, and they started doing inspections of homes on Tuesday.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think President Obama should be there?
I can tell you that our damage from Tangipahoa Parish kind of being the first place it got hit, and then it moved west to Livingston, East Baton Rouge, Ascension, and now you keep adding. It's going to be as significant as Katrina, and I would have to say that it's a catastrophe that warrants the attention of the president.
Yeah, and obviously many agree, although we have to point out there's also two parts of California that are being devastated by fire. It's just a really horrific time. And I just wonder your thoughts on Baton Rouge in particular, still recovering from terrible incidents. July 5th, the shooting death of Alton Sterling outside a market by police. And then days later, a man from Missouri came and a sniper and gunned down 3 police officers. Even though the Sterling family, said we do not condone that at all, we have police officers in our family. I'm just wondering, what's the mental state of people there?
Oh, I think if you look at how Louisiana came back after Katrina. It's just that this is just another part. How New York, how our Americans come back, but Louisiana specifically, since this is my home state in Tangipahoa, my home parish, that, you know, we're very resilient. We know what it takes to pull ourselves up and get back to work and know that we're going to be better. It's a tough time. We're not going to ignore that. And we have some people that are hurting, and we hug each other, and then we take off and go to work and make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot of organizations from around the region wanting to come in and help, and we're coordinating that. And that's probably I can tell you that search and rescue is hectic, and rearranging and coordinating relief efforts is almost just as hectic. At least we're not worried about, you know, getting somebody off of the roof of a house and our cars floating down a creek. But it's just as hectic to try and make sure that we're letting the people who want to help, that we give them a useful operation to take care of folks, and that the people who need it, it gets to them. We have staging areas sort of throughout the parish, and we have volunteers that are driving up and down the parish to deliver goods and services that need to be done.
Well, we'll connect people at our website, herenow.org. Robbie Miller, again, president of Tangipahoa Parish. Best of luck to you and your community there.
Thank you so much. We greatly appreciate you.
And another strange twist today in the story of the American Olympic swimmers who say they were robbed at gunpoint in Rio. Brazilian police now say the swimmers were not robbed. Instead, police say there was an incident at a gas station where the four swimmers apparently broke a bathroom door. So a lot of new details on this story emerging today. NPR's Russell Lewis is in Rio. He's on the line with us now. Hi, Russell.
Hey there.
So what's going on? Now there's a video at this gas station that surfaced. What happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, there continues to be more questions than answers at this point. The video has been posted. I watched it. It's about 7 or 8 minutes long. And sure enough, it shows Ryan Lochte and, you know, some of the other swimmers at a gas station, sort of looking around. They sort of walk behind part of the gas station. And apparently it's when they were trying to use a bathroom and trying to get into the bathroom, and apparently broke the door trying to get into the bathroom. And then they came out and got back in the taxi. And you can see some of the workers sort of looking around saying, gee, something bad just happened. And eventually they're taken out of the taxi and sit down and talk. And apparently it's because the gas station owner was basically saying, hey, you broke my door. You need to pay for it.
Yeah.
But what you don't see is, you know, you don't see a gun being held to Ryan Lochte's forehead, as he initially claimed. And it just sure seems like, you know, some Americans who perhaps were drunk and not behaving the best.
Well, I was going to point that out. This does not really fit in with the story that Ryan Lochte, the Olympic gold medal swimmer, and the other swimmers were telling. You know, Lochte seems to be going back now on some of the original details of his story. What do we know about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's important to point out that you know, this came to light when apparently he called his mom and told his mom something had happened, and then his mom went to the media, and then, you know, that's how the media picked it up, and that's when police heard this story was being kicked around quite a bit, that's when they began to sort of investigate, and they began to see that the story that was being told was quickly unraveling. They just couldn't find any proof of that, couldn't find anyone that could verify what had been said, and when you look at the videotape that's at the gas station, you can understand why.
Well, Lochte's back in the United States. That happened before the judge ordered the swimmers' passports to be confiscated. But Jack Conger and Gunnar Bentz were pulled off their plane last night in Rio. They've reportedly been released. But what do we know about what they face in the next couple of days as police keep investigating?
Well, in Brazil, it is a jailable offense to lie to authorities. They've had their passports taken away. They were questioned by police yesterday at the airport and apparently are actually at the police station now as we speak, undergoing some more questioning, and probably just trying to get to the bottom of what happened and why.
Well, what's on the line for the swimmers then? I mean, could they face charges?
Well, it's possible. I mean, I think, you know, likely what happens in these kinds of situations is that perhaps you might get your hands slapped a little bit. You know, they may have to pay some sort of fee or fine and then be given their passports back and sent back on their way.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, it has all of the elements of an international political incident, doesn't it? Because when news of the robbery came out, it was embarrassing for Brazil, and it was especially embarrassing for the police who were sort of implicated in the swimmers' story here. There's been a lot of conversation about the Olympics in Rio and if they've been safe enough and if the police are doing their job. So bigger picture here, Russell, how might this play out between even the two countries?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it's fair to point out that, you know, there are twice as many security personnel that are here at Rio than were at the London Olympics 4 years ago. I mean, security has really become a big issue that they've been very concerned about. That's why they put so many people in the streets, to try to make people feel safer. But, you know, Rio is a dangerous place. That street crime is a real big issue. It's something that, you know, people who come here are well aware of it. The athletes are told that in advance. Journalists are told that, you know, don't be crazy at night. Don't be stupid. You need to be smart. Keep your wits about you. And it's not a surprise that there is crime. You know, we've heard of athletes from Great Britain, as also from Australia, who have been robbed here just in the past few days. And, you know, it happens. But, yeah. You know, you just have to be smart.
Yeah. And that puts a little bit of a cloud on some of the sports that are still to come in these games. That's NPR's Russell Lewis in Rio de Janeiro. Russell, thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now. A coral reef off the Phoenix Islands in one of the most remote places on Earth is coming back to life. Researchers who've been making a trek for years to the Pacific nation of Kiribati say the reef is teeming with life again. The coral had been reduced to an underwater mountain of skeletons, bleached white by warmer and more acidic water. It's part of a trend that's choking once brilliant coral reefs all over the globe. I went to the New England Aquarium in Boston to meet the researchers who've been watching this reef so closely. You have to walk past school kids going gaga over the penguin exhibit and then go up an elevator to find Randy Rogin's lab. That's where I met Dr. Rogin and her colleague Jan Witting. They were standing next to a globe, and that's how we made our journey to the Phoenix Islands.
I'm going to spin it for you first because it's pretty fun. You got to go all the way around to the other side, just sort of about 1,000 miles south of Hawaii, and about 1,000 miles north of Fiji.
Literally in the middle of nowhere.
For us, it's certainly the middle of nowhere, where the international dateline meets the equator. So X marks the spot, is where the Phoenix Islands archipelago is.
That is fascinating. And Jan, you were just out there recently. It took you 2 weeks.
Yeah, it took us about 2 weeks to get there.
When you got to the Phoenix Islands and you saw the recovery that had happened there, was that a surprise to you? Because these reefs had been bleached out and basically given up for dead.
What we saw, what we knew from 2015 expedition was that there were signs of bleaching. And we knew from information coming from across the world that other reefs had bleached. So this was sort of a cliffhanger thing. We didn't know what had happened in Phoenix Islands as of fall of last year. So I certainly went with lots of trepidation, and it was a huge, huge relief and just exhilarating to see that the reefs were in good shape. Just the first sailing into the lagoon in Canton and putting your head in underwater and just seeing the vibrancy of those reefs.
What did you see when you put your head underwater?
So the first thing, of course, you know, when you're looking at corals is that you don't see white. The fish life, obviously, that's something that jumps at you and almost literally out of the water.
It does happen literally. I had a fish jump into our boat. It never happened. It was really amazing. Well, I just want to clarify the timeline here because it's really amazing. So in 2000 and 2002, when our team went out there, these reefs were thriving and they were incredible. And then in 2002, 2003, there was one of the most massive bleaching events that this site, as far as we know, had ever experienced, at least in recent times. And there was pretty mass mortality. About 60% of the whole protected area was marked for dead. And over the past decade, we've actually seen it marching sort of intermittently and sometimes in some places steadily, in some places more intimately towards recovery. And when we first jumped in the water a year ago, September 2015, at this Coral Castle site, that was when the first signs of recovery were there, and they were incredible. This place had almost come back to its former glory, and everyone was worried that just at this point of restoration and recovery that it was going to collapse all over again. And so the incredible piece here is that through this year, which is the third global bleaching event, the hottest year on record, we were sitting in a space which, if you look at the satellite temperature trajectories, it's a little terrifying. We all were pretty worried that something might have happened and that this recovery would have been back to zero. These reefs survived. And they're alive. They have managed to recover and then persist, and that is amazing.
So the question is, how did this happen? Because we know that bleaching occurs when the oceans get warmer, when they become more acidic because of carbon emissions, because of pollution. And yet NASA just this week put out a report that said this July was the hottest on record. We've had a very strong El Nino event that has pushed warm water in through past this area. How did it recover?
So if I can take a stab at that. So Phoenix Islands is sitting in a really interesting place oceanographically. So we're talking about a large body of water that features a lot of very energetic currents, ocean currents, right? I think you're probably swim in a lake in a summertime when, you know, you're at the top there floating and in a nice pool of warm water. And then you stick your leg down and you feel something much, much cooler down below, right? So you can imagine that if there is a current, a stream, say, that would disrupt, interrupt, and mix these two bodies of water together, you would actually cool the top layer. And so there are many mechanisms like these that can act in Phoenix Islands that makes them pretty unique in the oceanographic setting that can ameliorate these effects.
Does that mean to you that this is a one-off event because of its geography in the world? Because if you look at the Kiribati Islands, I saw some studies that said up to 90% of the corals there are bleached. And in the area around North America and the United States, there's expectations that 95% of the corals will be in conditions that will cause bleaching. So do you think that, you know, there's anything we can learn from this? And is it just a one-off sort of a thing?
I think there's two main factors at play. One is geography. And one is biology and conservation, which are going to go hand in hand here. You know, Kiribati is a huge country. You alluded to these other islands in Kiribati. There are three island archipelagos that each archipelago, sort of they span the spread of the continental United States. So one in California, one in New York. And so geography matters. Where these El Nino sort of epicenters form, where the hot spots are in the ocean matter. And also what protections are around them. You know, any reef that is already compromised because of a barrage of threats and stressors is going to be less prepared to deal with whatever the climate or the oceanographic features throw at them. The Phoenix Islands Protected Area is a no-take zone. And that's true as of January 1st, 2015. So there's no fishing. There is no coastal development. There's 29 people total who live there. You know, they just don't have a lot of the stressors that more coastal reefs or more highly visited reefs see. And so that gives us all the preparation we could possibly do, and then we got a little lucky.
There are souvenirs all over this lab from the many trips these scientists have made to the rejuvenated reef in Kiribati. Jan Witting opens a jar that smells like the ocean to show me a specimen he's preserved inside. It looks like a see-through spider, but really it's a larva of a lobster that lives on the reef. And the real prize is in a small back room that's filled with bubbling aquariums. Randy Rogin peers inside to show me her happy, fuzzy corals, each about the size of her fist.
And you can see some of them that are have their tentacles out and they're brown.
Yeah, they're squirming around.
I know, they're doing their thing. They look, I mean, when you look at them like this, you can really tell that they're animals, right? They look like anemones. They look like their relatives. And you can see some white ones, too. And the white ones, people typically think of as bleached, right? What we just talked about in tropical corals. But this isn't a tropical coral. This is a temperate coral that has the potential to transform our understanding of tropical corals because it can live with and without its symbionts that are so necessary for tropical corals but aren't as necessary here.
And symbionts are?
Symbionts are these tiny little intracellular algae that photosynthesize like plants. That is what give corals food in the tropics.
And when there's bleaching going on with the corals, those algae are expelled, and that's why the corals become white.
Yeah, but not here. Huh. Here, they just eat.
Interesting. So what do these corals have to teach us about what's going on across the globe with the coral reefs and the bleaching?
Two things. First of all, these corals live here in New England, which means that just like you and me, they deal with the hottest of hot summers and the coldest of cold winters, and they survive all of that. So this is a coral that's living in the extremes of what a calcifying coral can handle. And the second thing is this special property where they can live with and without their symbionts, which allows us to really ask what the role of symbiosis is in a way that you can't in a tropical coral. Because in a tropical coral, if you take away the symbionts, the coral's stressed and then dies. And here, you can take away the symbionts, and the coral's still okay. So we can ask that question.
Are you hopeful that there's a solution to this problem, or do you think we've sort of already turned the corner and are facing what could be long-term widespread destruction?
You know, look, we've already done a global experiment. We have more people on the planet than we've ever had before, and we are breaking new records every year. I think with climate change, people keep waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? They wait for the big disaster, but in reality, it's all these little disasters that accumulate and all these record-breaking events that are happening all the time. But there are still a lot of amazing spaces on this planet from which new life can regenerate and from which we can see recovery. And so I have great hope that all the work that so many of our science colleagues have done showing all of the various impacts and manifestations of climate change as a real and serious thing, now it's a political issue. And I'm hoping that people can do what they need to do to get it done.
And seeing the regrowth in the Phoenix Islands, is some of that hope that you're talking about?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we have to remember that these reef environments, these atolls, right, they're absolutely amazing formations. The corals have built the island itself on top of a volcano that's eroding away. And they've been around for tens of millions of years. When we're talking about the climate change issues, we're talking at this stage with the time spans of decades to some, you know, a century or so. We have to remember that these organisms have a much longer time view, if you will. So we need to set aside places where we make sure organisms will survive and then repopulate.
Hey, have you ever been to American Samoa reefs? Did you ever dive the Valley of the Giants?
Yes.
So have you seen Big Mama?
Yes.
This is like an incredible coral.
I've heard of it.
She is the size of this room easily, more bigger than that. Yeah, and she's around. It's been around pre-Columbus, and she survived all of this. And to me, that is just one of the icons of hope, right? There are corals that have made it through everything we've thrown at them thus far. There are places in the Caribbean that just evoke reactions of what the oceans were looked like before a lot of demise and destruction. There are some really incredible spots left, and those are the places that I really look to as places to get hope from.
Ocean optimism. I like that. Well, thank you very much for inviting us into your lab.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Randy Rogin is a scientist at the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium, and Jan Witting is an oceanographer with the Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. We've got photos from their most recent trip to the Phoenix Islands. You can see the blooming coral garden for yourself at hereandnow.org.
The Obama administration is reportedly preparing a new campaign to dramatically increase healthcare enrollment in public marketplaces under the Affordable Care Act. This comes just days after Aetna, one of the largest providers participating, announced it will pull out of the exchanges in 11 of 15 states because of financial losses of $430 million since 2014. But there may be another reason. In a July 5th letter obtained by the Huffington Post, Aetna CEO Mark Bertolini threatened drawbacks if the Department of Justice blocked a proposed merger with Humana, which the DOJ did 16 days later. Business reporter Ali Velshi joins us. Ali, this is not the first drawback from Aetna and not the first drawback from a major healthcare provider. But is this payback for that DOJ decision?
Well, it does seem, in July, Mark Bertolini, the CEO of Aetna, was pretty specific. He said that if the administration refused to let the merger proceed, Aetna would be in a worse financial position and it would force them to withdraw from most of the Obamacare markets that it's in. He actually said, quote, "It is very likely that we would have to leave the public exchange business altogether." So either it's payback or it was you didn't heed my warning and we're losing enough money. But the fact is, it's not the first, as you mentioned. And there is now a danger that enough of these insurers pull out, Obamacare stops being viable.
Well, we're reading in the New York Times that the Obama administration is trying to get more people to participate. That's what this letter was all about. And we're also reading, I mean, there's a whole debate over whether Obamacare is working. Some people say it's signing up so many people, it's working. Others are saying, as we're hearing Aetna say, it's too expensive, it's not working. But we do hear that healthy people aren't signing up,
yes,
while sick people are. Tell us more.
That's the issue fundamentally. Insurers are struggling with enrolling enough of the healthy people to balance the claims they get from the high-cost folks. They say they have been swamped with higher-than-expected costs, especially on the drug side, from specialty drugs. The Obama administration has said that insurance companies are having trouble adapting to the law, but they're going to adapt. They say they've made a series of tweaks, the administration has, aimed at bolstering the marketplaces. And the Department of Health and Human Services says it's going to modify some of the risks and the way people are categorized to absorb more of the costs for claims that reach above a certain threshold. But fundamentally, it is that mix that we all spoke about before Obamacare came into effect. Will enough young, healthy people sign up to offset the increased costs from the older people whose medical costs are high? higher.
So we only have about a minute here. Now the Obama administration is going to do a big push. How do they do it? How do they get? Yeah.
Well, they know demographically which groups are not enrolling at high levels. For instance, young Latinos are the least likely to be uninsured. Blacks and Hispanics have seen the largest decline in their uninsured rates, but they're still not fully there. So the Obama administration is going to target various groups and say, look, it is better for you to be enrolled in health insurance. We've sort of forgotten about it for the last couple of years. They're going to try and do that and get more people to sign in. But in the short term, you may see more drawbacks from insurance companies.
Well, it's interesting. You know, maybe you do have to do it every couple of years as people become old enough and start looking around and saying, hey, do I need insurance? Business journalist Ali Velshi, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Earlier this week, I reported a story about a man from Oklahoma who'd just been released from a 6.5-year prison sentence. He was remorseful for his crime, but nervous about rebuilding his life as a sex offender. Juan Guerrero was convicted of rape for getting a 14-year-old girl drunk and having sex with her. He was twice her age, and he met the girl at a shelter where he'd been working.
I was letting this power get to me, and I shouldn't have.
I read in the report that she told you, you know, you could go to prison for this while you were sort of in the heat of the moment. And you said, yeah, I know. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. I should have took that advice, because at the time, you know, nobody thinks they're going to get caught for what they're doing, you know, and when you're drinking. And I should have took her advice. You know, maybe she was more mature than myself.
Well, the story sparked a lot of debate. Survivors of sexual assault had no sympathy for Guerrero, but others said restrictions like the sex offender registry prevent sex offenders from integrating back into society. And we wanted to keep the conversation going. We're joined now by Amy Battersby. She's clinical director at Day One, a group in Rhode Island that provides support for victims of sexual assault. Amy, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem.
Well, in that story, we heard about the difficulty that sex offenders can have integrating back into society. But what about survivors? From your perspective, how hard is it for them to emerge from that trauma and regain any semblance of a normal life?
Well, we can start with the good news. And the good news is that now we know that there are treatments that are effectively helping survivors to get better much more quickly than in the past. However, violence crimes, in particular sexual violence, affect a survivor emotionally, physically, spiritually, behaviorally. It shakes their entire world. So it's almost as if you put different colored glasses on a person and then ask them to see their surroundings and their family and their friends in an entirely different way.
And can affect them for a long time.
For a very long time. We have survivors at Day One who were victims as children, 13, 14-year-olds, who are now in their 50s and 60s, who are still struggling with the impacts of the sexual violence.
You mentioned that there is some good news, that there are things that help. What does help?
Well, what we know now is the impacts on the brain. So what we traditionally thought of as therapy for survivors was talk therapy modalities, where you'd sit in a room, you'd talk about your feelings. And survivors typically had a hard time with that because they dissociate from the more difficult emotions related to their crime. So now we do a lot of experiencing with body and somatic ways in treatment. So yoga therapies really seem to work. Sensory-based therapies. For children, we use sand tray quite a bit. We use different sensory-based equipment that helps them regulate before processing their trauma.
Explain that. I mean, why would something like yoga or sensory therapies help more than talk therapy?
When someone's been a victim of sexual violence, their body becomes very unsafe. So when you're in an office and you're trying to describe the impacts of the trauma, your body instantly reacts to that conversation. So you might tighten up. You might have a hard time breathing. You might have heart palpitations or headaches or stomach aches. Doing something like a trauma-sensitive yoga group allows the survivor to be comfortably in their body, empowered with the choices that they're making, and in turn allows them to connect to their feelings and thoughts about their crime.
We know that survivors often know the person who assaulted them. In fact, more than 90% of child sex abuse victims know their perpetrator. And from your experience, is the trauma different depending on the age of the victim or even the relationship to the person that abused them?
You know, I think every individual has a different experience of their trauma. But I have to say that there's a level of betrayal that comes in hand when it's a family member or an acquaintance or a partner, which is typically what we see. So you do have to reestablish trust with people and others. You have to learn how to be a friend again and a family member again and really have the ability to connect in a way that you might have been able to prior to the crime.
And one of the reasons I'm asking that is because I'm certain that sexual abuse at any age is traumatic and terrible. But, you know, if it happens when you are a very young child versus when you are maybe pubescent or developing as a teenager, you know, where you are developing as a person both emotionally and physically, if the scars might last longer.
You know, I think the scars are lasting just as long for either crime. I think what changes is that as a small child, you don't have the words and the language to describe your experiences. So your brain develops differently. But as an adolescent, your ability to attach is really what's important. So your social relationships are primary in your life. So when sexual violence happens to you as a teenager, you really develop very unhealthy ways of establishing relationships, very unhealthy ways of self-care, and self-image becomes dramatically impacted.
And then, of course, if the trauma is lasting for a long time, down the road, years down the road, it might resurface because prison sentences, for instance, for rape vary, but they average about 8 or 9 years, which means that in many cases, a survivor of sexual assault may have to confront the idea that the person who abused them will be back into society. So talk about that. I mean, does that bring the trauma back up to the surface?
Absolutely. Actually, recently had an experience at Day One where one of our survivors knew that their perpetrator was being released from prison. And all of those fears, all of those hypervigilance experiences that this person had came right back. So every time they left the house, they were looking over their shoulder. Every time they turned the lights off at night, they were looking out the window. And those were all symptoms that had previously been dissipated.
As we mentioned in the story that aired this week, there are about 800,000 registered sex offenders in the United States. And of course, we also say that there are many more of their victims out there as well. But the critics of the registry say that it casts far too wide a net, that it's very hard or actually impossible to get off of, and that in a way it becomes this shaming tool for people who are trying to rebuild their lives. I mean, what do you think about that, about the value of the registry? And is there a way that it could be improved?
You know, I'd have to say I think that the shame that victims carry around every day far surpasses the shame of the registry. And I think that there's definitely a call to action for better rehabilitation services for perpetrators. We absolutely have to acknowledge that this is not the unintelligent man with the Coke bottle glasses that leaps out from the bush and gets a stranger for a victim. These are intelligent, professional men from all walks of life. We have to address that social myth in order to make change. And we do have to provide better education services, prevention services, and rehabilitation services. But when I think about shame, I primarily think about the victim who completely blames themselves every minute of their lives for the crime that's occurred to them.
How does it help the victims, though?
Well, I think that it provides a layer of safety for the victims to understand that there are people watching out for them. There are people that have heard them. There are people that recognize the impact on their lives, as well as the other people in society who might know the perpetrator or who might know the impact on the child.
The difficult thing is, and I understand your perspective completely, is that, you know, people who are on this registry and who might think they're on the registry for wrong reasons or or can't get off of it, you know, they would say that it just could provide the conditions that would put them back into prison and that would, you know, ultimately not make anything better for their lives, which is on the whole not good for society.
I hear what you're saying, but I have to say that only 2% typically of sexual violence crimes are prosecuted through to where the perpetrator is put into jail and put on the registry. So as somebody who works diligently with the court system, we see that there are very, very many crimes that don't go through to registry. And so the guys, I say men because particularly it is men in the state that are arrested and put on the registry, although there are women perpetrators too, we find that it's really necessary because the crimes that they have committed have had an impact so significant on the child and on the family and on the community in which they come from that there's really no other choice.
If there is someone out there who's dealing with this trauma but has not yet come forward, what would you say to them?
I would try to first tell them that there's no shame in a crime that happened against them. You know, I think as a society, we're so able to say if someone hits you in the face that that's not okay. But we don't teach our children from a young age that if someone touches you in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable, that that's not your fault. That's not something that you asked for them to do. So there's help. There's help in ways now that are short term. And there's a lot of people out there who have been through the same thing. And the support is unbelievable compared to what it was years ago.
It is hard to talk about. It's a fraught issue, and it's an issue that's stigmatized in our culture. And I can only imagine what it would be like as a survivor to talk about. So thank you for giving us that perspective. Amy Battersby, a clinical director at Day One. It's a group that advocates for victims of sexual assault in Providence, Rhode Island. Amy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
50 years ago, nearly everyone who died in the United States was buried. Today, just about half are cremated. Now, money is the primary reason. A typical cremation costs about $500 less than a typical burial. But demographics also play a role. Most people don't stay in the place where the traditional family plot in the hometown cemetery is located anymore. But as people rethink conventional burials, cremation is not the only option. Here and Now's Christina Sorensen reports on a San Francisco Bay Area startup's approach to burials.
Dennis White was 57 when his doctor gave him the news.
I have primary progressive aphasia.
That means parts of White's brain are shrinking, causing a gradual loss in the ability to process language and control movement. Doctors told White he might live another 5 to 7 years, and that was 6 years ago.
I can't talk or write. I can't climb stairs. Other than that, it's easy.
As his disease progressed, White started thinking about a very sobering question: what to do with his body when he died. White thought about cremation, but one day he was taken by a video he saw of a woman wearing a strange outfit, a body-hugging black suit covered with squiggly white lines. It was a TED Talk by artist J. Rim Lee.
So I'm here to explain why I'm wearing these ninja pajamas. And to do that, I'd like to talk first about environmental toxins in our bodies.
Lee goes on to describe the hundreds of environmental toxins that accumulate in our bodies, everything from plastic additives like bisphenol A to heavy metals such as lead and mercury.
So what happens to all these toxins when we die? The short answer is they return to the environment in one way or another, continuing the cycle of toxicity. But our current funeral practices make the situation much worse.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, goes the saying. But a typical burial today does everything possible to prevent a body from returning to dust. First, bodies are pumped full of embalming fluid, then placed in heavy caskets, and those get sealed in a solid concrete vault. And cremation isn't a particularly green alternative. One cremation burns enough fossil fuel to heat the average American home for a month, and the toxins in our bodies get pumped back into the atmosphere. Lee had a different idea.
I'm an artist, so I'd like to offer a modest proposal at the intersection of art, science, and culture. The Infinity Burial Project, an alternative burial system that uses mushrooms to decompose and clean toxins in bodies.
Lee says mushrooms occupy an interesting space in the biological world, right on the line between living and dead organisms.
Right, they're the master decomposers of the earth. They're present in every kind of decomposition situation.
Mushrooms help break down organic material so that it can then be used by plants. They also help capture heavy metals and other toxins and convert them to forms less hazardous to humans. That ninja suit J. Rim Lee was wearing in the TED Talk video, it's actually a burial suit. The squiggly white lines contain mushroom spores and other elements that can help speed up decomposition when the body is placed in the ground. No casket, no vault, no extras.
What we're proposing is that that return of the nutrients to the soil and to the earth, all of that return is meaningful and beautiful, and there's value in that.
Dennis White was sold.
I like the video, and I sent an email to Jay right away.
White's email came at an important moment for Lee. Originally, she had created the mushroom suit as an art project. It was something to nudge people to confront their fear of death. But more than a million people had seen her TED Talk, and some of them wanted to buy the mushroom burial suits. So she formed a company called Coeo to manufacture and sell them. And with Dennis's email, the company had its first customer.
It's great. And mushroom-colored is perfect.
Lee has worked with White and his family on all the aspects of preparing for his burial. Finding a cemetery that accommodates green burials, fitting him for a suit, and talking about how the family will deal with his death. White says it's been emotional for his family, but not for him.
We're all going to die sooner or later, but I happen to know approximately when.
White's condition has deteriorated substantially since I spoke with him, but he is still firmly committed to burial in the mushroom suit. He says when he goes, he wants to give back to the earth. For Here and Now, I'm Christina Sorensen.
Nice story. Mm-hmm. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.